Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by Fraser Nelson and James Forsyth. So the final countdown is on, the final deal is approaching, and yet defeat looks as likely as it has for several days, if not more likely. Now, James, the government have begun to realise they are heading to a catastrophic defeat, or at least people around Theresa May have clocked this. And there have been some attempts in the past 24 hours to try and mitigate that, perhaps with an amendment. How is that going?
So, if you can get an amendment that passes, everything else falls away, and therefore MPs won't vote on Theresa May's deal, and it won't go down to a thumping defeat. I think the message that cabinet ministers have been communicating in private and that they took to her at yesterday's meeting is, don't think you can lose this thing by somewhere between 80 and 120 votes and just come out and say nothing has changed. You know, it's just not going to work. A defeat of that scale will trigger a reaction that could end up in certainly the fall of Theresa May and possibly the fall of the entire government. So I think there is now a quest is on for an amendment that can pass. I think we had a first effort at this last night. That doesn't seem to have cut the mustard yet.
And what does that amendment say?
That amendment, I think, limits the backstop to a year. That hasn't cut the mustard because the DUP say, well, it's not in the withdrawal agreement, so it's not as... It wouldn't take precedence over the withdrawal agreement.
And is therefore meaningless.
And is, yeah, it's not meaningless because it's going to be interesting. There's going to be interesting. We'll come on to this in a second. But so I think what we will see is loyal backbenchers coming up with amendment after amendment after amendment until the government can find one that could command a majority of votes in the House and therefore would prevent this defeat. I think what is tricky here, which is what would worry me if I was the government, is John Bercow selects the amendments, and I think we can rely on him not helping the government out. And the other question is, you want, in the government's ideal world, that somewhere on a Venn diagram, there is an amendment that has some prospect of getting the EU to go at least halfway there to agreeing it. Otherwise, you end up with a problem, which is, Parliament have said do this and she can't do this, and then she has to bring the whole thing back and say, well, I know you told me to do this, but I can't deliver that.
I think the thing that the big problem she's got is you can't really have Parliament bolting anything on to an agreement that's already been signed and sealed with the EU and is going to be a treaty under international law. I mean, you can't really, if Parliament has got no force, it's like me adding a clause into Theresa May's employment contract. I mean, it's got no legal binding whatsoever. That's why I can't really see what the government... We're into the sweetener period now. And of course, Number 10 is going to give sweeteners to the deal. The EU will give sweeteners. But I think most of those, almost all of those who are opposed to it, will have factored this in. Of course, Theresa May is going to say, oh, by the way, you know, no Parliament can bind its successors. We reserve the right to stick two fingers up to the EU in 2-3 years' time. But also the House knows that Britain does not stick two fingers up to international law. We're not one of those countries. I mean, the French do that all the time. I mean, the Americans sometimes, but we don't. And the EU, I think the most it will do is one of these clarifications, which, again, won't change the text. And I think with the drama we've seen this week with the release of the Attorney General's legal advice, the reason that is so important is because we all know that the nature of this deal isn't really decided by what the politicians say about it. It's decided by what the clauses mean under court and how a court would interpret that as well. So unless that actually changes, I can't see a way of Parliament voting to change. They can vote for Theresa May to ask for a change, but they can't vote for a change.
Well, it is worth remembering that one of the greatest episodes in our history came from us systematically breaking international law when we ended the slave trade by boarding all ships carrying slaves in flagrant breach of international law. No, but I mean, it's not unprecedented for us to break international law.
Can you think of some time in the last 100 years?
Well, I mean, I think some people would argue that you get into a debatable proposition about whether the intervention in Kosovo was legal under international law. I mean, we can start off on a whole series
of whether the UN resolution covered what we did.
No,
but
sure.
We made
a case that it was covered under international law. So I think on the legal point, This is the one, if I was the government, the one thing which I think could actually do something is that the point in the Cox's legal advice is that the backstop can't last forever because Article 50 doesn't allow for the permanent future relationship to be done. I think one of the things that you could do is you could get the European Commission Legal Service to declare that it considers temporary to mean a certain amount of time, and that would essentially time limit the backstop.
But would it really? I mean, wouldn't it all, if there were to be a dispute over that, wouldn't it come down to this so-called arbitration panel? It wouldn't be to do with the legal centre of the EU.
I think there are letters that you can write that would have legal force that would have to be considered by the arbitration panel in interpreting what temporary in the agreement meant. People who know more about international law than me tell me that basically you could have an exchange of letters that would make clear what the word temporary in the document actually meant. Now, the reason why I can see the EU possibly doing this the reason why theoretically you should be able to see the EU doing this is A, they say it's temporary anyway, and B, because Ireland has a veto over the trade treaty that would have to be signed between the UK and the EU, the Irish could essentially use that to run the same playbook again, about if you want a trade treaty, you have to accept this and you have to accept that. The reason why I don't think it will happen, which I think is number 10's problem about getting any significant concession out of the EU, is that in Brussels, they are sitting watching the UK Parliament, and they think, well, if May's deal goes down, we'll either end up with Norway Plus, which in many ways makes the UK a non-voting member of the EU, or we're going to end up with a second referendum. And they regard both of those outcomes as absolutely fine. This is part of the problem for Theresa May, which is, you know, because she has so completely and utterly failed to properly prepare for no deal, she doesn't have that negotiating leverage of saying, OK, we'll just walk off the table.
And also, James, as you say in your cover piece, all of her antagonists, from whatever angle all think of their ultimate goal, would be advanced by the defeat of her deal.
Now, Graham Brady has suggested that Theresa May should perhaps postpone the vote if she can't get significant change on the backstop. He is the chair of the 1922 committee, which has led to speculation that maybe the number of letters is, for once, getting close to the 48. And he is trying to do something which will stop no confidence vote materialising. James, is there any chance of the government trying to move the vote? Because one of the problems here is because it is scheduled, they would have to have a vote in the House to move it at this point and win a majority on that, which they're not that good at doing.
I mean, there are other procedural ways that you avoid the vote. I mean, I think they have to avoid the vote because I think the trigger of the size of defeat that everyone thinks that they're looking at would be huge. I think there's another massive significance to Graham Brady doing what he did yesterday. When Graham Brady ran to be chairman of 22, he assured people he wasn't going to be one of those chairmen of 22 who's always out on College Green saying Tory MPs think this, Tory MPs think that. The fact he chose to go on television yesterday and convey this message is, I think, a clear sign that he thinks number 10 is not listening. And that is dangerous. I think that, you know, if you talk to cabinet ministers about their frustrations at the moment, there is a sense of you need to listen. And the fact that Graham Brady chose, who's a very discreet individual, chose to go on Sky News and say this, shows that people are getting frustrated, but the message is not getting through to number 10 and think they need to go and get a megaphone.
How can they move the vote?
How can they avoid it? Well, one way, as we were discussing earlier, is you get an amendment that passes, and then that amendment means that there's no vote on her deal.
Could you, in theory, have an amendment such as we vote for this deal on the condition that we negotiate a unilateral exit?
Yeah,
you could. Even though that might not fly with Brussels, you would avoid a defeat.
Yes, and you would avoid a defeat, yeah. I mean, I think number 10 would prefer something they have more chance of delivering than that. But I think if that is what is necessary to avoid defeat, I think that is where you will end up.
Now, talking of defeat, we have been given a glimpse, courtesy of ITV News, of the efforts in the Whip's office to try and win Eurosceptic rebels round, with exclusive footage which showed Julian Smith, the chief whip, speaking to Philip Davies, a Leave MP who has said that he doesn't plan to vote for the deal, and I think has also sent his letter of no confidence in on Theresa May. I suspect the idea here was to show that the government were trying to be the voice of reason here, because Philip Davies, while he has some fans, is seen as being one of the people in Parliament with quite extreme views. Fraser, do you think it worked out as they planned?
Well, I do suspect that was the intention, but we were looking at the footage. Philip Davis seems like the voice of reason, and Julian Smith seems to be deluded. I mean, he's saying, are you going to back the deal? No. Well, is there anything we can do to make you back the deal? And he says quite rationally, well, not really, because any offer you guys make to Theresa May's treaty will be legally meaningless. She has to go back and get another vote. And he's saying, so what can we do to get you to this point? You're saying, well, that, but you're not going to do it. So I'm going to vote against it. So When I saw that clip, I thought to myself, well, that is the quality of the government's arguments, and no wonder it's heading for a landslide defeat if all it can say is to pretend that it has got the ability to put one of these bolt-ons I was talking about earlier, which every MP knows legally will have no effect. So I can see why they are heading for that defeat, but what I can't quite see is why they would continue if they really think. I mean, the whips will know by now. They'll have had lots of these conversations. We'll have seen one on the ITV clip. They will know if they're going to lose by 100 votes, 150, 180. So why go through with the choreography? Normally governments pool votes then, but perhaps it's too late, or perhaps there's only a point in pooling a vote if you're going to do something else, and perhaps there's nothing else they can do.
And finally, we may or may not have a massive government defeat next week, depending on what compromises the government can pull. But we do know that whatever happens after that point, things start to get very difficult to plan. In your Telegraph column today, Fraser, you offer an insight into what the Tory leadership campaign might look like when it comes to ousting Theresa May. Can you share your insights with the front runners?
Well, right now, as ever with the Tories, it's more campaigns to thwart certain candidates. So I think the biggest caucus is the Stop Boris campaign. These are people like Dominic Grieve, Anna Soubry, Sarah Williston, and Nicky Morgan, who are saying that they would resign the government twip if Boris were to become leader. Rather, they would intend to declare that. In other words, they'd be saying to the rest of the party, if you put Boris in the final two, then you can kiss goodbye to your majority, because there are 20 of us who would resign the whip. Now, that's quite dramatic. I'm also quite struck by the fact that they're talking more about who it shouldn't be rather than who it should be. So, and the thing is, that's the way that Tory leadership battles work. Everybody's chosen for who they're not, not who they are. I mean, Thatcher wasn't Heath, John Major wasn't Michael Heseltine, Ian Duncan-Smith wasn't Michael Pertillo, David Cameron wasn't David Davis. So it was usually a front-runner and stop the front-runner. And then we're looking at Sajid Javid. He's usually spoken of as being one of the main contenders. But there's now even a Stop Sajid campaign, which is the ultimate compliment to think the Tory party can pay somebody. That's saying that, oh, he's boring, he's wooden, he's a banker, or look at his career in finance, any money, it was a bit dodgy, and things like that. And then you end up with Dominic Grab, against whom I haven't heard a bad word yet. So on the basis that the chap with the fewest enemies normally wins, it might end up being our former black belts champion, Dominic Grab. But politics is very difficult to predict in general, but Tory leadership contests are perhaps the hardest of all to predict.
James, can you envision a Tory leadership contest emerging the next couple of weeks?
I think if they find a way to avoid this vote on Tuesday, it is less likely you get to the contest, because the spark, which would be the massive government defeat, would be removed. I mean, there is a fascinating question about this contest, which is, could someone who was committed, who was basically prepared to seriously run the risk of no deal, make the final two? Could you get into that final? Could you get the, 106 votes to be certain of getting there? Could you get that? I think they probably could, but that would be a strain.
Because you think they're going to think what first and then who second? In other words, if the what is Norway, then the who would be somebody like, I don't know, David Lidington or something.
Yeah, I mean, there'd be massive opposition to a kind of to a coronation. Partly because in the constitutional order of precedence, David Lidington is the next in line. But David Lidington is also one of David Cameron's former Europe minister, is one of the most pro-Remain voices in the entire government in the referendum. So it's not like he would be uncontroversial to the rest of the party. The question then becomes, if someone won who was prepared to do no deal, could they then hold the parliamentary party together? Or could those people who are so opposed to no deal not be corralled? But I think things have definitely picked up yesterday, in that minister called me yesterday to explain to me how a cabinet minister had set about explaining to him in great detail the steps that an alternative prime minister would take to get out of this trouble. And the person ended the conversation by saying what a difference a new prime minister could make. And this person thought this was a kind of clear sign that this person, the new prime minister this person had in mind was themselves. And I think we will see more of this. But
it's quite embryonic at the moment, isn't it, James? I mean, given that we could, one of the many, many scenarios is that she gets spanked by 200 votes on Tuesday and then she resigns. In which case, we could be days away from a contest that they really don't seem very prepared for.
It is interesting that Boris Johnson has done it on Con Home this morning. He's basically set out the kind of Johnson manifesto of how to deal with this. What is going on behind the scenes is you are beginning to hear cabinet ministers do their own versions of this. They obviously have to do it in private, you know, which is a beginning in detail how you would handle the negotiation, how you would end up avoiding no deal, even though you were prepared to kind of countenance it, and all this. I think we will hear an awful lot of that in the next few days before this vote happens.
And it's funny, talking about the next few days, you know, rather than have a spectator Christmas party on Wednesday that we were intending to, we could be covering the meltdown of the government. There could be a Christmas leadership contest. It's funny to think just how busy the next few weeks could be. But I emphasise could, because nothing in British politics right now is predictable.
And rest assured that no matter what happens next week, you will be getting this Coffee House Shots podcast still, even if it is from a table from our Christmas lunch. And if you do want to get in the Christmas spirit, why not try our Christmas subscription offer, £99 for a full year subscription, and you get to choose between an Aspinall wallet or a bottle of Paul Roger champagne. Just go to spectator.co.uk/Christmas. Thank you, Fraser. Thank you, James.